ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
My view, if you are a bully and you're listening to this, your time is up.
Awareness of psychosocial hazards at work is on the rise. But is that having an impact on workplaces yet?
We want to say, oh yes, workplace bullying happened because there was one bad apple. So many employers just don't understand or don't accept or haven't come to terms with the fact that the way we deal with physical hazards is the same way that we can deal with psychosocial hazards like bullying.
Yes, you can do a lot of training out of a book, but I feel like sometimes when you've come off the floor and you move up to management levels, you kind of get disconnected from what actually works on the floor and what it's like to be on the floor.
Hello, I'm Lisa Leong, and for This Working Life, how to prevent bullying at work. And it might not be what you think. Dr. Annabelle Neal is a lecturer at Flinders University and the director of the Workplace Wellbeing Lab, where they've crunched the numbers.
Around 1 in 10 workers are experiencing workplace bullying at any given time. That percentage obviously rises when we look at bullying across the working life, so all the way up to around 40 or 50%. But prevalence data is difficult to come by because there are varying understandings of what workplace bullying entails. So that percentage can drop down to around 6%, and it can come up as high as 60 or 70%, depending on how it's asked and when and that sort of thing.
Let's go a little bit deeper now and really tease out what some of the behaviours are. Can you give us some examples then of workplace bullying so we can get that understanding?
Definitely. So bullying can occur in three main ways. We can think of it as work-related bullying, and this is where we might experience a sense of work overload, where we have too much work to complete in too short amount of time, where we don't have enough information to be able to adequately perform our roles, where we have that sense of lack of clarity around who we're reporting to or what our job actually entails, when we don't have the training and the skills to complete our role properly, all the way through to things like not having clarity about when we're supposed to be working, so rostering and scheduling of work, how we're managed when we're not performing as well as the organisation would like, and not receiving enough recognition and reward for the good work that we do. We also have personal bullying, and this is really the concept of bullying that I think most people relate to. So that's that kind of interpersonal conflict between people, shouting, spreading rumours, you know, socially excluding others from the workplace. I think that's, like I said, that's typically what we think of with bullying, but our research has demonstrated that that only occurs in a very small amount of cases and often in conjunction with those other forms of bullying. So when people do feel like they're not getting the information they need or they're feeling overworked, that's when that kind of conflict might actually arise, and that's when we start to recognise it as bullying, but it's been going on for some time before that. And then the third type is around physical assault or violence, so that kind of physical altercation that we might experience in the workplace. But again, that tends to be less common than work-related forms of bullying.
How might generational differences in workplaces be contributing to instances of workplace bullying?
I think what we're seeing is changes in the way that the generations are relating to management and supervisors in the workplace. So for older generations, I think there is that view that they come into work, there's a sense of authority there that, you know, may or may not be questioned, but it's always adhered to. They may take concerns up the chain, but it's done so less frequently. Whereas the younger generations coming in, particularly Gen Z, are far more comfortable in terms of expressing when they're not satisfied with some aspect of the work, or when they're seeing problems in the organisational system or flow.
You've done research focusing on prevention programs in a large retailer. Tell us about that.
So over a series of six or seven studies now, about 10 years of research, what we've been able to develop is a kind of diagnostic tool that identifies those parts of the organisational system that are kind of hotspots for workplace bullying. Things around, you know, whether or not there is enough reward and recognition for employees, whether they're getting the training and the development they need, how performance management's being you know, conducted, whether there's clarity within their roles. And so members of an organisation complete that diagnostic tool. We examine the results at kind of the group level or the team level. And then through a co-design process with that organisation, we unpack what's actually happening with those results. So why are workers experiencing that sense of poor recognition or unfair performance management? And then collaboratively design solutions to address and change the organisational policies, procedures, practices that underpin those kind of day-to-day management practices. So it's quite a simple concept, but we've found great success in doing it that way. And it's really underpinned by developing a sense of social cohesion within the groups, you know, rather than having these changes just implemented top down from, you know, management, bringing workers from all levels together to get, you know, understand what's going on, design solutions to change that, and then driving enthusiasm to implement them over time.
It's interesting because the diagnostic tool and that approach works at the structural level. I think people think that bullying might be a case of a bad apple. So how do you reconcile those, and what have you learnt through doing this work?
Yeah, there's actually a number of research papers with that exact title, Bad Apples in a Barrel, and we've tried to change the narrative to say actually it's the barrel itself that might be spoiling the apples there. One of the really cool things that our diagnostic tool allows is a kind of risk profiling in an organisation but across different sites. So we've done this with a number of companies now, and we can show an almost identical risk profile for these work management practices that are sites that are states apart, 100 kilometres apart, totally different staff, totally different management approach, you know, people in management and management approaches. But the same systematic issues keep coming up because they're embedded in the organisation's DNA and way of doing things. So what that shows us is that it's not necessarily just one individual in an organisation who might be acting, you know, unfairly or in a way that doesn't respond, you know, employees don't respond well to. It's a product of their organisational mandate that they are simply enacting. And that's actually supported by further research with alleged perpetrators of workplace bullying, and we've got very little research in that space, who've often said that when their behaviour was viewed negatively or deemed workplace bullying, they simply saw it as trying to execute what the organisation had set out for them to meet KPIs, to you know, run the organisation in a certain way. So they're simply adopting behaviours that have been set out in terms of the organisational structure, but do correspond with an increased sense of strain and distress for employees, mistreatment, which is what underpins that sense of workplace bullying.
Dr. Nadia Sturnova is a barrister at the Victorian Bar and a lecturer at the University of Melbourne Law School, and she also did her PhD on workplace bullying. I asked her if she believes things are changing.
Ultimately, I think that it is probably getting better. It's not necessarily reflected in a lot of the data that we're seeing, and that can be because the data a lot of the data sources can be quite slow to pick up changes that we're seeing over the years in Australia. Having said that, there is some data that indicates that there's more bullying than ever, and that might be because there's greater awareness of bullying. I think that we have seen some positive steps in relation to bullying. We've seen progress on some of the legislative and regulatory options that are available to people who have experienced bullying. And the research indicates that that is going to lead to positive change, whether we're seeing it in the data yet or not.
Nadia says there's still a big gap in understanding.
We have this absolute expectation now in Australia that employers will identify the risk factors,
to instances of potential physical injury and control those risk factors, eliminate those risk factors so that people aren't injured from a physical perspective. And what my research says is that we can do exactly the same thing when it comes to psychosocial hazards. The issue for us in Australia is that we just haven't gotten there conceptually yet. So many employers just don't understand or don't accept or haven't come to terms with the fact that the way we deal with physical hazards is the same way that we can deal with psychosocial hazards like bullying.
So if employers then start getting this awareness, what are some of the central things they can start doing then to address workplace bullying within their organisations?
Yeah. So the first thing that employers should look at doing is conducting a risk assessment. And ultimately, there are a lot of resources that are out there that have been out there for years that provide employers with a list, pages and pages of potential risk factors for workplace bullying. There are certain key risk factors that tend to come up time and time again. So we see things like the systems of work that exist in a workplace. So something like, for example, a remote or isolated working environment can be a risk factor for the occurrence of workplace bullying. We think about things like from a leadership perspective, are the leaders in the workplace really aggressive? Are they in fact engaging or exhibiting a leadership style that's facilitative of bullying? Or also, is the leadership style really weak and laissez-faire? So when instances of workplace bullying occur, the leaders aren't getting involved in order to stop that kind of behaviour. From a cultural perspective, do we have a culture that facilitates workplace bullying? Do we have, for example, a complaint system only in name, but actually when victims make complaints, they suffer or they fear that they will suffer retribution and harm in the workplace for making those kinds of complaints? Are there systems of poor issues of workload, poor issues of workplace support? So the first thing that a business can do is work through whether they think that those risk factors exist. And they can do that in a number of different ways. For example, by consulting with workers, by completing surveys, by using the knowledge that business leaders have. And then once those risk factors are identified, the next step for the business is to eliminate those risk factors, or if not possible to eliminate them, then to put control measures in place.
One of the areas of risk for workplace bullying is performance management. So what's the line then between performance management and bullying? Here's Dr. Annabelle Neal.
That crossover happens when that performance management action occurs in an unreasonable way. So we would expect that when people are going through a performance management process that they are offered some support, and certainly that there's a view towards actually trying to improve their performance, retain their position at the organisation. I think anecdotally we hear a lot of instances where people are exited from the organisation through that performance management process. So it's used unfairly or inaccurately to kind of remove people from a workplace, you know, for various reasons other than their performance there. But it should always be done according to organisational policy, and again, with a view of upskilling workers to bring them back to an acceptable level of performance. And when it's not done in that way, that's when we might consider it workplace bullying.
HR consultant Sarah Queenan helps businesses deal with cases of performance management gone wrong.
Some leaders are managing performance and they're not skilled to do that. And that results quickly in bullying claims, because people in a performance management situation are normally very sensitive as it is. And it only takes one comment from a leader, or, you know, combined with a couple of more comments that are really not well thought through, to potentially land that leader and employer ultimately in hot water in terms of a bullying claim.
Is that about the performance management process, or is it about the education of HR or even the managers who are doing the performance management?
Yeah, it's the education of managers that are doing the performance management process. So very much so in terms of that, that's a real opportunity area in terms of the stakes are higher, the risks are higher in performance management in terms of getting that right and not creating, a situation where, a bullying situation arises, because we want performance management conversations to be conversations that people come into with no surprises. So it's a really important area, and I think it is a high risk area for potential bullying type situations to take place.
Youth worker Jo and her colleagues learn firsthand what can happen when performance management goes badly.
We've always been blamed for everything that was going wrong in the house. And then when management were talking to other people, they were blaming us. So if we would go to a different location and say where we worked, every time we say where we worked, people would be like, oh, they're the troublemakers, or they're the ones that don't know what they're doing. So we would always feel very bad about ourselves, like we didn't know what we were doing. So it was just such a feeling of we were always wrong. And we kept saying to them, look, you know, if you put down directives in an email so we can follow the steps that you want us to do. But they didn't want to do that because then they knew that, you know, it would be in writing that something that that had made us do, we were just following their directives. So it was just sort of we felt a bit like we were always sort of set up in a way, but they didn't want to take accountability for anything.
Jo's case was resolved and her manager was given training, but moved on to another part of the organisation. I asked Dr. Annabelle Neal how to manage an employee who you think is underperforming without bullying them.
I think it's really important to take the time to understand what might be contributing to their underperformance. So, you know, scheduling in a conversation to ask about what's happening outside of work or inside of work, whether they are experiencing those negative interactions with co-workers, examining whether there has been changes to the organisational structure or flow of work in the last instance that might be impacting on their work. And then also facilitating that discussion to ask them what they might need in order to improve their performance. Employees are usually pretty good at identifying, you know, where they might need some additional help.
So what does Annabelle's research say helps to prevent workplace bullying before it occurs?
A lot of the work we've done with organisations starts with really simple things like reintroducing employee of the month or social get-togethers, you know, once weekly or monthly to kind of thank employees for the work that they're doing, an email that goes around acknowledging certain individuals or teams that have performed well that week, just simply putting a coffee machine in the, you know, break room so employees can actually, you know, recaffeinate in between shifts or when they come off the floor for a little while, you know, identifying through one-on-one conversations who may wish to progress within the company and then setting up those training and development pathways for them, examining the kind of role descriptions that each employee has and making sure everyone does feel clear about what their job entails and clarifying any discrepancies there.
We spoke with former Vice President of the Fair Work Commission, Joseph Catanzaretti, ahead of this story. He says boards need to get more involved in dealing with and preventing cases of workplace bullying. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. Boards and senior management are really what drive the resources, but also the culture around how bullying is managed and viewed in an organisation. So when they send the signal that this is something that they want to address and get on top of and create a safe, healthy work environment for employees, that mindset trickles down through to middle management and to frontline workers. And certainly when they can provide the resources to undertake these sorts of, you know, diagnostic procedures and co-design interventions, that's when the real change actually happens, rather than just sort of setting a mandate at the senior level around zero tolerance to bullying, which is almost never actually enforced. So it becomes a meaningless placard in the company. So being part of those conversations, actually sitting down with employees from all levels to hear about what's going on, being open to the idea that things aren't humming along as well as they might think that they are, and expressing that genuine care and support for the well-being of their employees, because we know that healthy workplaces and where employees feel well really drives productivity at all levels.
Youth worker Jo says bullying at her workplace could have been prevented with a different approach.
There needs to be a meeting once every 3 months or whatever, or a one-on-one every now and again, where the CE actually meets someone that actually works on the floor. because then you skip all of those steps in the middle. Something is happening. They hear it from the horse's mouth. So it doesn't have to make its way up four or five levels and not make it at some stages. Just have a round table with us, you know.
Dr. Nadia Sternova agrees that prevention should include everyone.
One of the key things that we say is that if a workplace wants to eliminate workplace bullying, if a workplace is really serious about addressing workplace bullying, then we talk about needing organisational buy-in. So that means that everybody is committed to the elimination of workplace bullying. And one of the main ways that we commit people to the elimination of workplace bullying is by making it a KPI of senior leaders, of the people in culture team, of line managers, the people who have the power at law and practically within organisations to make change and to implement the measures that are necessary for workplace bullying. So the research shows time and time again that you want everybody on board, and that includes, you know, every worker as much as possible, right? You want to take everybody along for the ride. You want everybody to be committed to this strategy, but absolutely you want that senior, the most senior leadership buy-in that you can get.
How important is oversight of what employers are doing when it comes to preventing workplace bullying?
In Australia, we have had, for example, safety regulators that have been producing guides largely describing what I've described for a long period of time, more than 10, 15, 20 years. But the research has shown that employers haven't been implementing those strategies, these evidence-based strategies, that the evidence really strongly supports the position that they would assist in the reduction or the prevention of psychosocial hazards like workplace bullying. And the research is really interesting. I think I've always thought that research has been really interesting about why employers, why businesses haven't been implementing these strategies. And part of the reason is that a lot of employers really struggle to conceptualize the treatment of psychosocial hazards like physical hazards. I mean, it might sound simple when we're talking about it, we're explaining it today, but we can't see psychosocial hazards in the same way that we can see physical hazards. And we haven't been talking about psychosocial hazards for as long as we've been talking about physical hazards. So a lot of employers haven't really understood that there are these resources there and that they are there to be implemented in the same way. Also, these phenomenon that we're talking about, workplace bullying and sexual harassment and other kinds of psychosocial hazards, they're complicated. Often what we want to do is we want to reduce them to interpersonal issues. We want to say, oh, yes, workplace bullying happened because there was one bad apple. Sexual harassment happened because there was one bad apple that engaged in that kind of behavior. And if you're a business owner and that's your understanding of workplace bullying and sexual harassment, and to some extent it's understandable that people would see it that way, because that's what they're seeing. They're seeing a person or a group of people engaging in bullying, a person or a group of people engaging in that sexual harassment. They might think to themselves, oh, well, what I need to do is I need to deal with this person. I need to deal with the relationship between these two workers. But again, the issue there is that if you're only dealing with things at that person-to-person level, you're missing all of the factors in the workplace that allowed that behavior to occur. Of course, a lot of businesses, they don't want that additional regulation. They don't want the administrative burden of completing these quite prescriptive steps that come through. And we need to be realistic and we need to be honest about that and to understand that part of the process as well. But the point about that oversight is that it's more likely that businesses will implement these kinds of strategies where we have that evidence base that they're going to be effective. And also, if we have safety regulators that are involved in these processes, the safety regulators can provide that kind of educative assistance, as well as obviously having that kind of enforcement function as well.
Thanks to Dr. Nadia Sternova, barrister and lecturer at the University of Melbourne's Law School. And you also heard from Dr. Annabelle Neal from Flinders University, HR consultant Sarah Queenan, and youth worker Joe. And for background information that helped in putting together this episode, big thanks also to Joseph Cantanzariti and psychologist Carol Egan. A link to our earlier program about the human cost of bullying in the workplace is available in the show notes. Next time, we're going to help you turn that potential snooze fest, the work presentation, into something powerful that sticks with your audience. Thanks for listening to This Working Life with me, Lisa Leong. It was produced by Michelle Weeks, mixed by Kerry Dell on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naam, Melbourne. Until next time, work it like a charm.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.